Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of my comrades in arms in that war is our executive vice president at the Center for Security Policy. He's a man who has actually served in uniform and brandished the arms of the Army Special Forces as a Green Beret. He is a man who has come to become, something of a prominent figure in the commentariat these days, notably with frequent appearances at Fox News and in his tweeting and blogging and videos. You can find all of this at securefreedom.org and elsewhere. But I do want to just say, Jim Henson, how much I appreciate the clarity that you've been bringing to the whole issue of this global jihad, and in particular to plug, actually, for a change, fairly positive assessment of what we do at the Center for Security Policy and, of all places, the New York Times today. In a front-page story where they're talking about the administration considering designating the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk a little bit about the Brotherhood, if you would, Jim, as a man who has looked hard and dealt in all kinds of ways with the enemy. Do these folks constitute, as you see it, terrorists and threats to this country?
Well, first, Frank, I think we'd better check and make sure that was the actual New York Times and not a parody site, because that seems to be a fairly significant departure for them.
It is.
It also might be evidence of the fact that enough light has been shined on the bad deeds of the Brotherhood and all of the, you know, its organs worldwide, that even they can't ignore it. And that would be a significantly good situation.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd go that far yet, Jim, but at least this was a fairly balanced piece.
Well, let's take the fact that they're now talking about it as a good thing, because the more it gets talked about, the more the fact that the Brotherhood is hardly the Islamic social relief agency and, you know, bearer of sweetness and light and the milk of human kindness. They're just not. Now, they occasionally may bring some poor people some food. They may do some social work. But if that is one portion of an agenda that includes putting the rest of the world under the iron sandal of Islamic oppression, I don't think that's good enough. And I don't think in any way that inoculates them against the accurate charge that they are a terrorist organization. They enable, fund, plan, operate, and are the largest non-state distributor of terrorism in the world. They, for a while, had control of Egypt. And, you know, fortunately, the military looked at what they were doing and said, this will not stand. I'm not a big fan of military coups, but when terrorists are running your state, I think that's one time it's probably okay to have one.
Yeah. And to be clear, the Egyptian military, of course, stepped in as something on the order of 30 million Egyptians were in the streets saying the same thing. So it's definitely a popular response to a perceived shared problem. And at the moment, I think the Egyptians are very actively urging our government to do as they have done, the Egyptian government, that is, namely designate the Muslim Brotherhood. But Jim, as you've looked at this organization in this country, I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of what they've been up to for some 50 years is not so much nonviolent as pre-violent. Talk a little bit about the infrastructure that the Brotherhood has been putting into place and the extent to which it's been tied to a lot of the acts of terrorism that have taken place in this country.
Well, the bottom line with the Brotherhood is they figured out a while ago that they were not going to conduct a military conquest of Earth. That wasn't the way to do it. They knew that they wanted to basically be in charge as many places as they could, and that the easiest way to do that was from the inside. You know, if you go ahead and set up organizations ostensibly to be social relief and, you know, Muslim social welfare organizations, but whose true goal is to actually promulgate the Islamic supremacism that the Brotherhood stands for and proudly proclaims, they can do a better job of that than attempting to take on somebody. You're not going to defeat the United States militarily, but what you can do is go ahead and create a situation where the president of the United States serves as an advocate for groups that are actually antithetical to the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah. And what do you say, Jim, to those who say, well, that's a conspiracy theory? Is there actually evidence that that kind of activity is underway at the hands of the brothers and their friends?
You know, the perfect example of this is CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. It was formed to replace Hamas for fundraising activities in the United States. The FBI was watching them. They were watching Hamas right before they designated Hamas a terrorist organization. And they have wiretaps of Hamas and its friends forming CARE to be a front organization to do fundraising for Hamas in the United States.
And political warfare, too, as I recall.
Exactly. You know, they're on record saying this is what we're doing. And Hamas is a card-carrying member of the Brotherhood worldwide. And consequently, they have been able, through CARE, to basically push an agenda that is un-American, anti-American, in the guise of a social welfare organization. And they've got the American left partnering with them, claiming these are the good Muslims. We know that these are the bad guys, and they're actually oppressing the only Muslims in the country who would be good, you know, members of society, who are, you know, they're keeping them down, and we've got the bad guys in charge. And in this, President Obama was complicit.
We've been taking direction from the bad guys, as you say, in what we can think and know and say and do about standing up to them as they seek to take us down from within. And let me ask you about a particular problem that I've been trying to get my hands around. And I don't know that we've got the full story on it just yet, Jim Hansen, but what do we know about this gang of people with Muslim-sounding names that were providing IT services to, I'm told, as many as 40 Democratic members of Congress, including members of sensitive committees like the Intelligence Committee in the House? What do we know about what they were up to, who they were, what purposes they may have been pursuing?
What we know for certain, and this is basically, there's been an investigation called into the fact that this group of, I believe, three brothers, I don't know how much their sister was involved, but with some fairly sketchy backgrounds. These are people with multiple bankruptcies, fraud, and other things in their backgrounds, who somehow managed to get into support roles that would give them access to the emails and other sensitive files of members of Congress, including, as you said, some members who sit on the House Select Intelligence Committee. How you can actually be running an organization that takes care of the important parts of our nation's business, like Congress, and not be able to do background checks or counterintelligence checks on people who you're going to give access to all of your information, I can't even fathom. Apparently, these guys were stealing, for sure, equipment. You know, so they have been conducting fraud and stealing equipment. We're waiting to see what the report says about what information they've stolen or what other purposes it may have been put to. But the simple fact that they were there with no screening, no vetting, you know, which seems to be a shortfall of the previous administration, is absurd. You couldn't do that anywhere else. You couldn't do that for a corporation. Why is Congress somehow less important than that?
Yeah, to the contrary. I think by most measures, it would be more important than your average corporation. Jim Hansen, very quickly, we've got less than a minute left here. What do you make of the fact that among those members of Congress was a man who, at the Center for Security Policy, we've done a lot of spade work on. In fact, we've got a dossier on, I think it's been described as, namely Andre Carson.
Andre Carson's a bad guy. He has taken money from some of these front organizations we discussed, the Brotherhood front organizations. He took he's the guy who has basically been speaking at their events and giving the imprimatur of a U.S. congressman to groups that actively oppress women, who believe gays should be killed, you know, who have absolutely un-American beliefs. And he's speaking at their events and showing the world that, from his opinion and others, they are decent organizations and people we should be working with. A guy like that should have gotten nowhere near the House Intelligence Committee, and that was a disgraceful act by Nancy Pelosi that hopefully we can get changed.
Amen. Well, we'll watch closely the results of this investigation. I hope that it will really find out what these guys were up to and whose service, and for that matter, that of Andre Carson as well. Jim Hansen, thanks so much for what you do as the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy and your service to our country, which you're continuing handsomely in that role. Keep up the good work. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we will speak with Daniel Horowitz about judicial tyranny and what it means for you. That and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Daniel Horowitz is one of the relatively young men who I've come to admire tremendously for his knowledge and his insight and his courage and his, well, I don't know how else to say it, perspicacity on matters involving the law most especially, but really the condition of our country, our civilization. He is senior editor at Conservative Review. There he authors a column entitled The Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz. He is also the author of an extraordinarily timely book, Stolen Sovereignty, How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel Horowitz, I know you wrote that a while ago, but man, it's great to have a chance to talk to you at this particular moment in time when so much of what you warned of is much in evidence. Good to have you back.
And it's great to be with you, Frank. I take no pleasure in having the thesis of my book play out in real life. I warned about this, and unfortunately, it's unfolding right now, Stolen Sovereignty, in its quite literal sense.
It is indeed. You know, I say the same thing myself. We'd always just as soon be wrong, because if we're right, it's really bad for the country. But talk a little bit about this stolen sovereignty in the crucible of the judicial review of and interference with President Trump's executive order limiting temporarily, as we'll be talking about with other guests in the course of the show, this problem of immigration and refugees from failed states and hostile ones.
You know, when I wrote my book, Stolen Sovereignty, last year, the thesis of the book is really about two converging things. One half of the book is about out-of-control immigration. The other half is about out-of-control courts. And then the convergence of the two together, out of control courts, stealing the sovereignty of the nation, of the individuals, of the citizenry, preventing us from controlling our own future destiny, the right to self-determination. And what I started seeing throughout the Obama years is that as bad as Obama was in immigration, there were times where the courts were even to the left of him.
Even worse. And this is a point I want to drill down on with you because we can't believe how much this branch of government is abusing its powers. This isn't an accident, is it? This is by design, I take it.
No, I mean, this really started with the Warren era in the 50s, where, you know, we always had three co-equal branches of government. And in fact, it wasn't even that equal. The judiciary was supposed to be the weakest branch because they aren't elected, and therefore they do not have the power of the purse, the power to execute, the power to enforce decisions. They merely would give judgment opinions on individual cases and controversies under the law, under it, meaning interpreting the statutes passed by Congress, signed into law by the president, or a parallel process on a state government level. Now, what happened was over the years, they started getting into constitutional interpretation with Marbury versus Madison. And that was fine, given that they had concurrent jurisdiction over that. Starting the 50s is where they said, no, we're the sole and final arbiter of every social and political question. In my mind, and what pushed me to write the book was Obergefell. That was when the courts redefined the building block of all civilization, marriage. And I parlayed that onto one other issue that I called and I warned about as the final frontier in judicial tyranny, and that's sovereignty, national sovereignty. So they redefined the building block of civilization. Now they're redefining what it means to be a nation state. So I go through in my book and in a lot of my writings for 200 years of case law. Not only did the court say Congress and the president have plenary full power to decide who comes, who they want to deport, assuming that individual is not a U.S. citizen, they said it is not reviewable by the courts. I'm just going to give you one quote from a 1977 case, "This court has repeatedly emphasized that over no conceivable subject is the legislative power of Congress more complete than it is over the admission of aliens." And now, with a flick of the wrist, the courts are just throwing that out as if our history, our sovereignty, the entire social contract of why we have government to protect us doesn't even exist.
Now, Daniel Horowitz, my understanding is that this judge out in Washington State, Robart, I believe it is, didn't actually provide much in the way of a legal thesis on the basis of which he was making this sweeping decision, transformative decision. Is that right? And how on earth can he get away with that? Obviously, the Ninth Circuit is one way he can get away with it, given its makeup and proclivities. But can it really be the case that justices in, say, the Supreme Court of the United States would tolerate such nonsense?
Well, I mean, look, they've already tolerated that, a long time ago. And this is our fault. Could he get away with it? Of course he can, because over the last number of years, we've imbued this notion into the public consciousness, into the body politic of America, that the courts are the sole and final arbiter. So they could literally do or say anything. I was talking with some friends and asking just philosophically, is there anything a court could do that people won't say it's the law of the land? It's funny, if you pass a statute and it's signed into law and stands for 150 years, it's evidently not the law of the land because the courts could make it not the law. But if a court makes something up, somehow that's just inviolable, unassailable, and there's nothing we can do. So you're right. It's absolutely unprecedented. Usually, if you're going to issue a nationwide injunction, even if it's an emergency stay where, obviously you don't have time to really write up a whole scholarly opinion, but you'd give a couple of pages just explaining which statute, which clauses of the Constitution do you feel it violates. If you're going to say there is an affirmative right for potentially any one of the 7.2 billion people in the world to come and immigrate here and lose our national sovereignty, you better show your work.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Daniel, because what I prize about you so much is not only your clear-eyed view of problems, but also your creativity in thinking about what can be done about them. And the subtitle of your book, Stolen Sovereignty, is How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. So what would you recommend be done in a circumstance like this, where at the moment we seem to be moving, at least if Andy McCarthy is to be believed, inexorably towards an affirmation of this judicial tyranny, as you call it, that practice by the Supreme Court of the United States? What can be done as a practical matter?
So, the first part of my book is recognizing the severity of the problem, which I think the conservative legal community, which honestly is kind of really more of a libertarian community, I don't believe they appreciate the severity. We have to just first shake ourselves out of our slumber. They redefined marriage. They have literally redefined sexuality now. The circuit courts are saying a man's a woman's a man. I mean, this is nuts. It's got to stop. We will not have a republic left. And now, like we see, we cannot even prevent Somalis from affirmatively coming into the country. So what we need to remember is that Article 3, Section 2, it grants Congress full authority over the jurisdiction of the court. So there's two things. The lower courts, Congress could make them, break them, divide them, all the administrative procedures they could control. There's nothing they could do that Congress cannot control. Congress created them. It's an institution created by them. The Supreme Court is mandated by the Constitution, but what's known as their appellate jurisdiction, which is almost 95% of cases, except for some real esoteric cases, they are subject to the regulations and exceptions that are made by Congress. So even to the extent they have illegally grabbed control of immigration, Congress could say that, at least I would advise starting with the lower courts. The lower courts do not have authority to adjudicate any case granting a right to anyone to enter or remain in the country against the national will who is not a U.S. citizen, period. It is not reviewable. There is nothing they can do about that. It is settled law, an endless stream of case law on that. And otherwise, we're not a nation at all. It could be done statutorily.
And very quickly, Daniel, should this judge be subject to impeachment as well?
So this is a multi-fronted war. I have an article, 8 different facets of judicial review. I mentioned jurisdiction stripping. Another one is impeachment. Yes, we do not have the votes in the Senate to actually remove. But keep in mind, it's a pretty bad thing to have on your resume that the House, which It's a simple majority vote to impeach him. They should absolutely do that. Make impeachment great again.
We have to go, Daniel Horowitz. We'll be back with you again very soon, I think, because, again, your book and, of course, your columns at Conservative Review are going to be incredibly important in thinking our way through this debacle. Thanks for your time today, Daniel. Godspeed. Next up, we'll talk with Christian Adams. We'll get his take on what's happening inside the Justice Department, what it might mean for all of us, and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by J. Christian Adams, a man of extraordinary ability, courage, and I think clarity when it comes to some of the most important legal and, for that matter, national security challenges of our time. He is, among other things, a former attorney in the U.S. Department of Justice, where he served as a civil rights attorney. He is these days a columnist at PJ Media, the author of the New York Times bestseller, Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department, also associated with the Election Law Center. J. Christian Adams, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Hi, Frank.
Well, let's start with this controversy, if we can, Christian, about the executive order that the president has instituted on immigration. In particular, I'm interested in sort of your take on how the Department of Justice has conducted itself in the interval between the inauguration and the arrival, hopefully, in the course of the day today. As we talk, it's beforehand, but by the time this airs, it will have been hopefully accomplished, the arrival in the Justice Department of a new Attorney General, Jeff Sessions.
Well, look, the law cannot be more clear on this issue. The president has absolute authority under the law, an unambiguous federal statute, to stop the entry of particular classes of aliens into the United States. It's an absolute power of Congress under the Constitution, Frank, and Congress delegated this to the president, this power. The one branch of government that has no power over the issue is the judiciary. Unfortunately, that's the branch that has exercised power over this issue by blocking the executive order, frankly, in a shockingly, in my view, unconstitutional fashion.
And, Christian, the exception to that sweeping authority under the law, as you say, U.S. Code, Section 8, as I recall, is an earlier law that says there must be no discrimination. Is that the source of the present controversy and the claim by opponents that this executive order is in fact itself unconstitutional?
Well, I mean, look, if it were, that would be a slight bit of comfort. But as you know, it's not a religious test. But what gives me trouble is the fact that the federal court found all of these bizarre interests of the state of Washington were implicated in an injunction hearing, such as we aren't going to get enough workers. Well, really? You've got a flow of workers coming from Iran to work on tech issues? Because if that's the case, that raises a whole new set of questions. But, you know, the executive power of the president is very, very clear on this. And he has the power to stop the influx of migrants or refugees or aliens coming from any part of the world that he deems to be a threat.
Yeah. And how, as a former denizen of Maine Justice, Christian Adams, how do you view the kerfuffle over the acting attorney general, a woman by the name of Sally Yates, who interposed herself in this controversy and was summarily removed from office? Does she have the right or does he?
Well, she shouldn't have been there in the first place. She should have been fired on January 20th at 12:01, along with a whole slew of other political holdovers. And this is a real problem that's going to keep cropping up. There are going to be more Sally Yateses down the road, both in public. They're going to come out of the woodwork, as well as they're going to behave in acts of private sabotage, because the entire administrative state, particularly a DOJ, remains in the hands of the ideological left. there are people who have been moved, I know their names, into key positions in the political office of the DOJ on January 18th. In other words, the Obama administration elevated them into counsel slots, which are essentially political positions masquerading as career slots, to embed inside the political offices of DOJ. This happened across DOJ. It is a prescription for disaster for the Trump administration. And unfortunately, these people were not removed on January 23rd, the first full Monday. They should have been sent back down to their nests with all the other partisan bureaucrats, but they weren't. And it's going to spell trouble for the incoming attorney general.
And as you've written in your book, Injustice, Exposing the Racial Agenda of the Obama Justice Department, that's a problem that is really rife in the department, that agenda, and it's actually bigger than the racial one, as you know, better than anybody, Christian. But it's also true in other departments, of course, across the government, and risks, really, I think, in a very ominous way, as you said, sabotaging the Trump presidency. Hey, let me turn to another aspect of your very important work, Christian. You're a real specialist on the matter of voting practices and voter fraud specifically. Give us a flavor of how you see the current debate about whether there is, in fact, in a serious and meaningful way, voter fraud taking place, notably in the last election, and whether it is high time that we have a serious, rigorous investigation of what's been going on in that regard.
Yeah, Frank, look, this is a serious problem. We have gone and documented through litigation across the country, and particularly in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the names of over 1,000, and this is just in 8 counties in Virginia, over 1,000 people who were removed from the rolls for not being citizens. These were only the ones who were caught accidentally, and they were voting. I have the names on my desk, an inch-thick file of voter records of non-citizens who are casting ballots in American elections. It's a more serious problem than not having voter ID, because a lot of these aliens have voter ID, because the reason they got on the rolls in the first place was through motor voter when they went to get a driver's license. And so it's easy for a non-citizen to get a driver's license. It's legal in many places like North Carolina, Virginia, California. And so the problem is aliens on the rolls. It is a fact. It is occurring. And the Obama Justice Department did absolutely nothing about it. They turned a blind eye to it because it benefits them. That's the bottom line, Frank. When you have 800,000 or a couple million aliens or ineligible people on the rolls, it benefits the Democrat Party. And that is the central reason why nothing has been done about voter fraud. And it's the central reason why the institutional left makes fun of anybody who ask questions about it, because it helps get them power.
You've described the problem very well, it seems to me, but can you characterize whether when Donald Trump has raised concerns about it being potentially millions of people, including people who actually voted in the last election, is there evidence that that's right in your judgment, or just we don't know how significant the problem is, but it could well be impacting elections, if not the last one, those going forward?
Well, the problem is that nobody knows, because the entire media institutional left apparatus has made fun of the idea instead of asking the real questions and doing the real data mining they should have done. And the administration can fix this. A private party does not have the ability to get the answer, but the incoming administration does, because they have access to key data banks. They have access to the SAVE database, which is a DHS database at Homeland Security, of every alien in the country who's touched the federal system, meaning do they have a visa, do they have a green card, have they been caught at the border? If they have, they're in the SAVE system. So and now the ones who haven't been caught are not in SAVE, but at least it's a start. The federal government also could have access to all the state voter registration lists. That's something that no private party easily can obtain. And so the federal government under Trump and Sessions and the new DHS chief could compare these two databases and scrub to see how many aliens are on the rolls, because we know it's happening. We know they're voting in Florida, Virginia. There's been exposés where they've actually admitted to doing it, and they don't have any problem with it. Sometimes they think they were allowed to because they were asked if they wanted to register at DMV.
Right, and otherwise encouraged to vote, including, I think, by the last president of the United States. Christian Adams, there's so much more to talk about. I hope that we'll have a chance to visit with you in particular about efforts you're helping with to get better voting ID restrictions in place. And we appreciate that work that you do at the Election Law Center and, of course, at PJ Media and beyond. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll talk to Diana West. We'll get her take as to what's going on with this war on Donald Trump and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. Each week we have the privilege of visiting at about this time with Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist. These days she is a blogger par excellence. You can find her work at dianawest.net. You can also read her two terrific books, The Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, it's good to have you back.
Thank you. So much to talk about.
There is so much to talk about, and I know that you have been very supportive of Donald Trump. One of the things, of course, that he made very clear in that campaign was that he was going to try to improve our ability to differentiate between people who are hostile to us and people who want to be part of the fabric of our society and so on. In that connection, he has, as you know, promulgated an executive order that temporarily puts restrictions in place on immigration from several troublesome countries. This has precipitated a great controversy, in fact, perhaps now a constitutional crisis in the making. Talk a little bit about what you think is going on, Diana, and whether, in fact, this is more than just a concerted effort by Trump's opponents to take him down.
Well, I think it's all of the above, if that makes any sense. What you have with Donald Trump's fairly limited executive order, in my view, although we're talking about it as if it is a cataclysmic, or the left will talk about it as a cataclysmic, astronomical kind of order, in terms of staying the entry from seven Islamic countries into the United States for 90 days, is an effort to reassert the whole concept that America has interests separate not just from the Islamic world, but from the world. In other words, to reinstitute a sense of hierarchy and order that has not existed in this country really since World War II. And it is a huge, as we've discussed, this is the cataclysm for not just the left, but the establishment. Because we have been marching along to New World Order and global governance and all of these terms that are used frequently on the left in the establishment right to describe a world in which nation states do not assert such prerogatives as to who enters, because the whole point of it is to erase nation states and their boundaries. And so I think this one little step of this executive order, which is really quite modest in its scope, 90 days, seven countries, big deal. There are 57 countries in the Islamic conference or cooperation, as we know. So this is actually quite a modest step to look at countries that have, you know, are failed states, essentially, and that import violence and security issues along with their immigration and refugee resettlement. This is a very modest first step toward reestablishing this, I won't call it a new order, but an old understanding of what our country is and what sovereignty is. And I think this is why you see the hysteria, because it might work.
Well, and it also is the case that the president, as J. Christian Adams was just sharing with me, has the authority to protect our sovereignty in this fashion. It's unquestionable in terms of the clarity of the law. And yet it seems as though we are at risk of having the courts strip him of this subject we talked about a bit with Daniel Horowitz. But Diana, one of the things I wanted particularly just to visit with you about is that we have this phenomenon of a lot of people, it seems, saying, Well, yes, in principle, we don't think we ought to be bringing in more people who want to kill us, but you can't infringe upon their rights to come here. Talk about whether they have such rights in the first instance, and secondly, are there reasons to be concerned that people, in fact, either wish to come here to kill us very directly, I mean, a sort of terrorist kind of problem, or the problem of people simply wishing to come here for the purposes of subverting our country and its form of government?
Yes, I mean, we are in a period of crisis. And to make up these kinds of rationales to try to stay the president's hand, which, as the other guests are observing, is absolutely based in very clear law, is just more of this same effort to attack the law, to attack the election process that brought Donald Trump to power on this very issue. I mean, this really is his signature issue, whether it's building a law or reestablishing American sovereignty, particularly in terms of immigration policy, which is run amok, which is absolute, not just a disgrace in terms of what it means, but just a bureaucratic nightmare and filled with corruption and bringing chaos and misery to the land, which is, I think, the words, almost the words, from John Podesta's intelligence report on the fate of Europe in the face of this similar kind of migration. In larger numbers, of course, but we can learn so much from Europe's example. From WikiLeaks, we learned that Podesta was informed in a way that these leftists and establishment right people are ignoring. And we just have at Gatestone today a piece by Soren Kern on the situation of the demographic transformation of Germany to an Islamic state, in which there are leaked intelligence documents essentially stipulating in no uncertain terms that with this kind of immigration and migration, Germany has imported a failed state. Violence, Arab anti-Semitism, intra-Muslim fighting and violence, all manner of misery and chaos that they have imported, and that essentially Donald Trump is asking us to pause and reconsider and look at it and really get some kind of discussion on. I don't think he will succeed unless he opens up the conversation from an attempt to forestall the very isolated terrorist incident to a larger conversation about what specifically is happening in Europe in terms of Islamic culture dominating, shaping, and truly bringing to extinction what we know of European life, or maybe our parents would have known of European life as visitors, and what we used to know maybe 20 years ago in terms of visiting Europe. This is civilization war, and it is not just carried off by terrorists or even agents of Islamic entities. It is simply the import of Islamic culture that changes a region to an Islamic culture. And there's quite a lot of the world that is devoted to that, and fine. But the point is, do we wish to change to that? And I would say the American people said no. And what we see are the elites in the judiciary and elsewhere attempting to essentially subvert an election process and subvert the will of the people, and now blatantly trying to overturn settled law that gives the president these powers to protect us.
Yeah. And in the process of doing all of that, of course, essentially creating conditions under which we may fall prey to a similar kind of phenomenon, perhaps not as quickly because the numbers are smaller, but inexorably as we head towards a similar kind of state of accommodation and ultimately of submission to these Sharia supremacists.
Well, if we look at Sweden and Britain, which are terrible examples of Islamized Europe.
I think you mean they're prime examples of a terrible phenomenon.
Yes.
That not be more accurate?
Well, true, but the Muslim demographic in both countries, which are essentially, I mean, Sweden in particular, a failed state at this point, under 5%. So we're looking at small numbers. This small numbers turn very quickly in the way Islam exerts itself, the way Islam lives. I mean, this is not to say anything about Islam, except that this is what happens when an Islamic demographic starts to go over 1%. It changes very quickly, particularly because they tend to concentrate in cities where so much of a country's life is essentially radiates from. And so this is part of what you see across Europe. But look at Sweden, look at UK. You can go to YouTube, and this is what I hope Donald Trump does one day. I hope he shows the American people what is going on all of the footage exists, all of the stories exist, and our media won't tell us.
They exist, I believe, at dianawest.net, which I commend to all of our
enough.
Listeners as a place to take stock of the footage that you're describing. Diana West, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.